Welcome to Gruesomely Gorgeous. I'm your host, Taylor Wells. Joining me, my fellow narrator, Crystal Nail. All of our stories are researched by our criminal justice expert, Caitlin Brandt. Together, we are Gruesomely Gorgeous.
In 2000, ABC News documented a series of cell phone calls to families with terrifyingly specific death threats. The unidentified callers knew exactly what the families were doing and wearing. The families say the calls come in at all hours of the night, threatening to kill their children, their pets, and grandparents. Voicemails arrive playing recordings of private conversations, including ones with a local police detective. The caller knows, the family said, what they were doing, what they were wearing. And after months of investigating, police seemed powerless to stop them. This went on with the Kendall's family for months, who reported a caller with a scratchy voice threatening to slit their throats. When the first Chris Washington police tried to find the culprit, the calls were traced back to the Kendall's own phones when they were even turned off. It got worse. The Kendall's and two other First Chris families told ABC News that they believe that the callers are using their cell phones to spy on them. They know their every move, where they are, what they're doing, and wearings, and have recorded private conversations of all.
California cyberstalking. A mere 3 weeks after California passed a law against cyberstalking, Gary Dallapenta, I don't know how to say his name, is charged with using the internet to solicit the rape of a woman who had rejected his advances. So Gary terrorized a North Hollywood woman by placing ads in her name that claimed that she had rape fantasies and provided her address and instructions for disarming her security system. It's terrifying. At least six men saw the internet ads and came to the woman's home. And many, many more called her saying obscene things and leaving messages. But then on January 1st of 1999, California had become the first state to ban cyberstalking, or stalking that involves electronic communications. Gary went afoul of the new law, using the internet to get back at the woman who had repeatedly rejected his romantic interest in her. At first, the woman had no idea why men were banging on her door in the middle of the night, saying that they were going to rape her. When she finally learned about the internet ads, she placed notes on her doors explaining that the ads were false. However, Gary then placed new ads saying the notes were part of the fantasy. He was caught when the father of the victim pretended to respond to the ad and trace their origin. You gotta love dads. In April, Gary pleaded guilty to one count of stalking and three counts of solicitation of sexual assault and received a 6-year prison sentence. Only 6 years.
A federal grand jury this afternoon returned a 26-count indictment that charges a Pasadena man with making a series of detailed threats to harm, rape, and kill 10 victims he met in various social and business settings. Samuel Hughes, 31, who is a citizen of the United Kingdom, was charged with 7 counts of stalking, 9 counts of making online threats, 3 counts of mailing threatening communications, and 7 counts of witness tampering. The indictment alleges that Hughes, sometimes using his real name and other times using aliases or social media accounts designed to conceal his true identity, sent his victims communications in which he expressed hope that they would die or in which he made specific threats to harm them. For example, in October of 2019, after one victim reported prior threats from Hughes to law enforcement authorities, Hughes allegedly sent the victim an email stating in part, "Someone I can guarantee will come out and first bash your head in, rape you, slash your throat, and burn your car and house." Hughes allegedly sent out another threat that read in part, "I will rip your fucking throat and stab you in the eyes and put gasoline over your half-mutilated body." Court documents state that Hughes used online aliases and handles that included Xavier.Herrera666, ParsonTheo38, TheoParsons4, Tony.Hawk.XSkater, Tony.Flaville450, ByWord.Photography, Julius.Caesar411, Charlotte.Massey400, and A.Total.Wanker400. The FBI began investigating Hughes in May of 2019 after one victim filed a complaint with the Internet Crimes Complaint Center at www.ic3.gov. After being contacted by both the FBI and state law enforcement officers on multiple occasions regarding the threatening communications, Hugh continued to send electronic communications and letters threatening to injure, rape, or kill at least three of the victims who have reported his threats to the police. According to a criminal complaint previously filed in this case, in his communications to some victims, Hugh threatened that contacting the police would lead to the injury or death of the victim or the victim's loved ones. As a result of separate investigations, Hughes was arrested by the LA Police Department and the Pasadena Police Department on two occasions in June, which resulted in charges being filed by the LA County District Attorney Office and the Pasadena City's Attorney Office. Federal prosecutors filed a criminal complaint against Hughes on July 10th, and he was taken into custody from state authorities on July 24th. Hughes has been in federal custody since that time. The charges in the indictment are allegations, and the defendant is presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. The stalking counts and charges stemming from the alleged threats all carry a statutory maximum penalty of 5 years in federal prison. The witness tampering counts each carry a maximum possible penalty of 20 years in prison.
What seemed like a horrific stalking case was a jealous lover's cover for murder. David Krupa watched his cell phone blow up with dozens of text messages from his stalker. "My favorite thing to do is stand outside and stare at you," one message read. Krupa, 36, was almost used to it by now. He would go on to receive tens of thousands of texts and emails like this over a 3-year period. The messages are rife with jealousy and rage at first. Then, over time, the tone changes from spiteful to threatening. "I hate you so much that I want to drive a knife into your heart," read one message. "I will destroy your life and take your happiness," read another. Krupa said he can't remember how many times he changed his phone number, and yet the messages kept coming. "What do you do when somebody invades every space of your life?" he asked. They all appeared to be from Carrie Farver, a woman he dated for only 2 weeks in Omaha, Nebraska, but no one had physically seen her in a long time. It was years after the harassment began that detectives uncovered a vindictive lover who had gone to extreme and deadly lengths to destroy her perceived rival. Author Leslie Rule was so fascinated by this story that she wrote a book about it called A Tangled Web. Rule's name might sound familiar, as she is the daughter of legendary true crime writer Ann Rule, who wrote the classic book The Stranger Beside Me, about her friendship with Ted Bundy. Krupa moved to Omaha in 2012 after taking a job managing an auto repair shop. At the time, he was separated from his longtime girlfriend, Amy Flora, with whom he had two children. It was his first time on his own in a while. "I didn't know how to venture back into the dating pool," he said. "I felt pretty rusty, so internet dating was the way to go." Krupa said he signed up for a couple dating sites. The first person he met through one of them was a woman named Shannon Elizabeth Goliar, who went by Liz. "I thought Liz was very pretty. I was attracted to her right away. So then we set up a date." Goliar told him that she was a single mother with two kids who were around the same age as his kids. By the fourth date, Krupa said their relationship escalated and they started having sex. But Krupa said he was also up front with Goliar, telling her that he wanted to continue seeing other women. About 6 months after meeting Goliar, Krupa said an extremely attractive woman walked into the auto shop. It was Carrie Farver, a single mom who had brought in her Ford Explorer for maintenance. "When we looked at each other, there was a little spark," Krupa said. "She's showing me something inside the vehicle, and we're standing there, and we're very close, and there was some tension." By all accounts, Farver was vivacious and warm, according to friends and family. "You noticed Carrie when she walked into a room," said her friend Amy Long. "She had a laugh, she had a smile, she lit up a room. You couldn't help but notice her. You were drawn to her." Krupa asked Farver out and said the two immediately hit it off on their first date, so he invited her back to his apartment after dinner. As things were heating up, Krupa said Farver told him she didn't want anything serious. "I felt like I hit the jackpot with that," Krupa said. But as she was leaving his apartment at the end of their date, Krupa said Farver walked right by Goliar, the other woman he's dating, in the hallway. They passed right by each other. It was just a brief encounter, maybe 10 seconds or less, but this encounter would go on to have lasting ramifications for all three of them, said Jen Carpenter, host of the So Dead podcast, which followed the case. Krupa was so quickly taken with Farver that when she was tasked with a big project at work, he offered to let her stay with him. Farver worked as a computer programmer, and her office was located around the corner from where Krupa lived, he said, whereas she lived nearly an hour away in a different town in Iowa. On the morning of November 13th, 2012, Krupa said he got ready for work, kissed Farver on his way out, and told her he would see her later that evening. Then, around mid-morning, Krupa said he got a strange text from her saying she wanted to move in together, which was very left field because we had already talked about that not happening, he said. Krupa texted her back saying that he wasn't interested. She responded almost immediate, saying, "Fine, I hate you. I'm dating someone else. I don't want to see you anymore. Go away." "Lots of profanity," Krupa said. "I didn't know what to think. I was blown away." When Krupa returned home that night, Farver was gone. Nearly 2 days passed before he said his phone started blowing up again with texts, in which Farver said, in part, "I hate you. You ruined my life. You're a terrible person." At the moment, Krupa said he thought, "I don't need this. I dodged a bullet." Farver's mother, Nancy Rainey, says her daughter was diagnosed with depression in her late 20s. A few years after having her son, Max Farver said she was eventually diagnosed with bipolar disorder. "She had been seeing a therapist and was on medication," Rainey said. There was a couple of times when she would stop the medication because she said, "Mom, I feel like I'm numb." But by the time Farver was dating Krupa in 2012, Rainey said her daughter was in a good place, working at her dream job in Omaha, and Max was a thriving high school student. Around the time Krupa was receiving those intense text messages, Rainey said she too began receiving strange texts. One message claimed Farver had taken a new job in Kansas, which Rainey said totally threw me. She tried to get Farver on the phone, but said her daughter wouldn't call back, which was unusual. When Farver didn't show up on her half-brother's wedding day, Rainey reported her missing. Rainey said she told the police her daughter was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and that she was on medication. The police jumped on that and said, "Well, this is the kind of thing happens all the time. When somebody who's bipolar stops taking their meds, sometimes they can have erratic behavior," said Rule, who wrote A Tangled Web about the case. Rainey said she couldn't get the police to take her pleas seriously. But then ABC News reached out to the sheriff's office for a comment on the initial stages of the investigation. In a statement, they said, "The department takes all missing persons reports seriously, no matter what the circumstances surrounding them." The available evidence during the initial investigation was inconclusive, but we did not give up, it added. Meanwhile, Krupa said he continued to receive hundreds of harassing text messages and emails from Farver. "I will do what I can to make you suffer," one message said. Another read, "We belong together, Dave." He said most of the messages focused on Golier, the woman Krupa had been previously dating and who crossed paths with Farver and Krupa's apartment. Golier told him that she was also receiving harassing texts and emails. One day, Krupa said Golier called him, saying her garage had been vandalized. Upon pulling into the garage, she found that someone had written "Whore from Dave" on the inside in spray paint. Golier reported the incident to the Omaha police in late November of 2012. As the weeks went by, Farver continued to miss more family events, including her own birthday, her son's 15th birthday, Thanksgiving, and then her father's funeral. Rainey was convinced something was wrong. She said she was still getting texts from Farver and begged her daughter to call her so that she could hear her voice, but she never did. She said Max also started getting messages from her saying she was going to Kansas and coming to get him, but she never showed up. Rainey said the texts became mean and angry, saying that I wasn't a good mother and that I was controlling. She noticed that oftentimes, the texts would be full of grammatical and punctuation errors, as well as spelling mistakes, which she said was out of character for her daughter, who was a stickler for punctuation and spelling. For Krupa, the harassment wasn't just over text and email. He was also being stalked. On one specific occasion, I was sitting on my lazy boy with my feet up, watching TV and trying to relax. And it's nighttime, and I get a text saying, "I see you. You're sitting in your chair with your feet propped up, wearing a blue shirt." And all those things were true, he said. One night in January of 2013, almost 2 months after the harassment began, Krupa was returning home from work when he noticed a familiar vehicle in a nearby parking lot. As he got closer, he realized it was Farver's Ford Explorer. Having worked on the car, he knew it fairly well, so he said he took a photo of the license plate and sent it to Omaha police. When police searched the car, they were able to find only a single fingerprint on a mint container. It didn't match Farver or anyone in the FBI's national database. Meanwhile, weeks turned into months, and Rainey still hadn't found her daughter. One beacon of hope arrived 5 months after Farver disappeared, when Rainey said a man called her to tell her that he had seen Farver at a homeless shelter and that she wanted Rainey to pick her up. I was shaking. I thought, oh my God, We're going to bring her home. She's going to be okay, Rainey said. Rainey said she raced over to the shelter and that investigators met her there. But when they arrived, they learned Farver had never even been there. It was such a letdown, and I was devastated, Rainey said. I get this raising in my hopes, and then it's dashed again, and I knew somebody was playing games here. 6 months into Farver's disappearance, Max decided to message his mother's Facebook account to see what would happen. She messaged back. It said, "Hey, little man, how are you?" Carpenter said. He asked her to answer 3 questions to prove it was really her. What's his middle name? What the name of their first dog was? And what his best friend's name is? And she never responded to that message. All the while, Krupa and Goliar, who are still seeing each other on and off, were still receiving hostile, nasty text messages. It was actually extremely common for us to be hanging out on a couch watching TV or something, and both of our phones would start blowing up with text messages and emails from Carrie, Krupa said. At one point, Krupa said he got an email from Farver threatening to kill Goliar, and that it included a photo of a woman tied up in the trunk of a car. Krupa called Goliar, who confirmed she was fine. Later, Krupa said Farver sent him a link to a fake obituary for Goliar. Then, in August of 2013, Goliar's house caught fire, killing her family pets, all that's sad, including 2 dogs, a cat, and a snake. Fire investigators believed it was arson, and Goliar told the police she suspected Farver was the culprit. Krupa said he had become so paranoid, by that point he had bought a gun, a 9mm Smith & Wesson pistol. Terrifying intrusions kept happening to him. At one point, the auto shop where Krupa worked was vandalized. In January of 2014, Krupa was at his high school friend Heather Twelt in his apartment. When Twelt said she watched his phone blow up with messages and then later heard someone jiggering the front door handle when they were in bed that night, Tweet said a brick was thrown through the window. Krupa's ex-girlfriend, Amy Flora, the mother of his 2 children, had also received threatening messages from Farver. It wasn't just Dave and Liz. It was anyone in Dave's life. It seemed Carrie had it out for them, Carpenter said. By spring of 2015, it had been 2.5 years since anyone had seen Farver, yet the harassment continued. Detectives Ryan Avis and Jim Doughty of the County Sheriff's Office in Council Bluffs, Iowa, had never worked on the case, but they had heard about it in the office. They were so intrigued by Farver's mysterious disappearance that they volunteered to take it on. The 2 detectives decided to approach the case from different angles. Jim's going to work on it like she's dead, and I'm going to work on it like she's alive, and I'm going to try to prove every which way I can that Carrie is still out there, and Jim is going to prove and try every which way that she's not, Avis said. So they started from the beginning and digging through the original case file. The detectives were aware of Farver's bipolar diagnosis, but they didn't think that it had anything to do with her disappearance. Avis thought it was alarming that there hadn't been any activity in her checking account the entire time that she had been gone. It is not normal for adults to just up and leave and literally spend no money. No one's seen them and no one's heard their voice. It just doesn't make sense. Avis said she had good income, a good house. I had come to the conclusion that I could not prove she was actually alive. Doughty said the glaring detail that stuck out for him was Goliar, who he said had never been involved in Farver's life until she went missing. All of a sudden, she's the focus of harassment, he said. Her name was all over the reports, so to me, there was something with Liz. She definitely was a person of interest. The only forms of communications anyone had received from Farver were electronic, so Doughty and Avis asked their colleague, Anthony Cava, a digital forensics administrator at the county sheriff's office, for help. Both Krupa and Golier had agreed to have the content of their phones downloaded in 2013 for the initial group of investigators. This content was included in the original case file, and Kava started connecting the dots. "We knew these messages don't seem to really be coming from Carrie Farver," said Kava. "Carrie, or the imposter who was pretending to be Carrie, sent Dave about 15,000 email messages over a 3-year span. It might have been upwards of 25,000 or 50,000 texts in all. Whoever was pretending to be Carrie got more and more sophisticated in what they were doing to try to hide their IP address, to try to hide their real identity," he added. The investigators found a photo of Farver's Ford Explorer in Golier's phone dump, which included metadata that showed the photo had been taken about a month before the police recovered the vehicle. Somehow, Liz knew where Carrie's vehicle was before law enforcement even did, Dottie said. "Another thing we found on the phone download was there were 6 calls that were made to Carrie's residence. It was using the *67 prefix to disguise the number. So Liz was calling Carrie 6 times. This didn't make sense to us because she had only met Carrie 1 time passing through the hallway." The investigators also found the photo of a woman who had been tied up, which had been emailed to Krupa, and determined that it had been taken by Golier's phone. They also discovered a video recording that showed someone walking outside of Krupa's apartment. It had been uploaded to YouTube under Farver's name, but was tied to an IP address registered to Golier's house. In May of 2015, Dottie and Avis went to interview Nancy Rainey, during which they said they believe her claims that her daughter was missing and that something had happened to her. Dottie said, "I just want you to know, I don't think she left on her own free will." And that was the first time anybody of authority position had told me that, she said. "Honestly, I felt like something was going to happen now." During their meeting, Rainey provided investigators with another clue. She told them that after Farver disappeared in 2012, she received a text saying Farver had sold all her furniture and asked Rainey to let her buyer into the house to pick it all up. As supposed proof of sale, Rainey received a photo of a check for that furniture that was made out to Farver and signed by Shanna Golier. "We knew Liz Golier's real name was Shanna," Dottie said. "It was yet another connection between the two women who supposedly were strangers." Granted, that didn't give us any answers on what happened to Carrie, but we knew that Liz knew more than she was telling us. The investigators also matched the mysterious fingerprint found in Farver's car to Golier. As their investigation went underway, Krupa realized the pistol he had purchased for protection was missing. He reported it stolen to the police. On December 4th of 2015, Dottie and Avis were at the county sheriff's office when Golier walked in. Stunned to see her, they learned she was there to file a harassment complaint against Krupa's ex-girlfriend, Amy Flora. After Golier left, Avis drove over to her house to interview her, pretending it was about her complaint. She told Avis she now thought it was Flora who had been sending her threatening messages the whole time, not Farver. The investigator asked if he could download the content of her phone so they could review the messages. Golier signed the consent form and turned it over. Avis said he couldn't believe she agreed to it. Getting access to the information on Golier's phone was an important moment in the investigation. During the conversation, Avis said Golier mentioned she knew Krupa's gun, which she correctly identified as a 9mm Smith & Wesson, was missing and thought Flora had stolen it. She realized that she probably shouldn't know any details about the gun, and then any further questions I asked about the gun, she was very vague, Avis said. In a bizarre twist, Goyer called 911 the following day, claiming that she had been shot in the leg while walking alone at night in Big Lake Park in Council Bluffs. Investigators said Goyer at first claimed she didn't know who the culprit was, and then she later said she thought it was Flora. I found it highly suspicious that the day before she felt the need to tell me that Dave Krupa's gun had been stolen, and less than 24 hours later, she is shot, Ava said. It was pretty quickly determined that most likely Liz Goyer had shot herself. Police said that Flora was cleared that same evening. Meanwhile, Kava got to work sifting through the contents of Goyer's cell phone after the second download. He discovered Goyer had registered upwards of 20 or 30 fake email addresses, all of which had some variation of Farver's name. Kava also discovered that Goyer was using an app which allowed her to schedule future messages. This explained how she could be with Krupa and both their phones would get bombarded with messages. She was able to send messages pretending to be Carrie, and they would arrive while she was sitting on the couch next to Dave, Kava added. From Dave's point of view, Liz couldn't have sent it because she was sitting next to him the whole time. Kava estimated that Goyer must have spent about 40 to 50 hours a week impersonating Farver. This seemed to be a full-time occupation for her, trying to stalk people and send them messages, he said. Dottie and Avis brought Goyer in for an interview 2 weeks after she was shot. At the time, they said Goyer kept pushing them to investigate Flora and had no idea she herself was their main suspect in Farver's disappearance. Dottie and Avis came up with a plan. They were going to tell Goyer they believed her story that Flora had shot her and they wanted Goyer's help to get Flora to incriminate herself. They asked Goyer to reach out to Flora and see if she would tell her anything about what happened to Carrie Farver. Of course, the detectives knew Flora had nothing to do with Farver's disappearance or the threatening messages that had been sent for years. Their plan worked. They said Goyer almost immediately fabricated emails she said were from Flora. We started receiving messages that said they were from Amy Flora, where Amy confesses to shooting Liz at Big Lake Park, Dottie said. He and Avis continued to press Goyer to ask Flora, who they knew to be Goyer, for details about Farver's death. 10 days later, Goyer did exactly that. She forwarded them an email that supposedly came from Flora saying she had stabbed Farver 3 to 4 times and stuffed her body in a garbage bag. The details were bone-chilling because they were graphic, Dottie said. As time went on, the investigators said Goyer grew increasingly upset that they hadn't arrested Flora. Dottie explained to her that he needed more information. Information only the killer would know. Within hours, they had more confession emails from Flora. The emails included that Farver had been stabbed to death in her own car. These emails gave us Carrie's vehicle as a crime scene, Dottie said. What we wanted to do was go back and look at the vehicle to determine if that crime happened there. This was the third time police had searched Farver's car, but this time, Dottie says they pulled the fabric off the passenger seat. Once uncovered, they found a red stain that was determined to be Farver's blood. Because the murder was most likely taking place in Omaha, the Omaha Police Department had to be involved, and cold case homicide detective Dave Schneider joined the investigation. Detective Schneider brought Goyer in for questioning and confronted her with the evidence Dottie, Avis, and Kava had gathered so far. The photos on her phone, the IP addresses traced back to her house, and the confession emails from Flora. Goyer denied knowing anything and claimed she didn't have internet service. But while she was being interrogated, Dottie and Avis had gotten a search warrant for her apartment. Inside, they found some of Farver's possessions, including a digital camera and a camcorder, which they believed Goyer had stolen from Farver's home. On the camcorder, they found video of Farver talking about how someone had vandalized her car. It was time-stamped 2 days before she disappeared. On December 22nd of 2016, Golyer was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Douglas County attorney Brenda Beadle, who prosecuted the case, said, "This was by far the most difficult case I've ever tried. Most homicides are dark. This one was bizarre, to the point where it would take some convincing to make somebody believe that it actually happened," she said. "There's no way to know that someone would shoot themselves in the femur." Golyer's defense attorney, James Martin Davis, requested to waive a jury trial in favor of a bench trial, meaning a judge would decide the case. Not only was there no body, there was no crime scene. There was no murder weapon. There was no proof that she even did it, Martin said. He waived the jury trial to move it up so it could try this case, hopefully before they'd find the body. Then, a few months before the trial, it was set to begin in 2017. Krupa remembered he had a tablet in storage and turned it over to investigators. On the tablet, Kava discovered a micro SD memory card that also had been in Golyer's phone around the time of the murder. The SD card had thousands of deleted images, all of which he was able to recover. "I came to a photo that no one had seen before," Kava said. "I wasn't sure what I was looking at first, but it turned out to be a human foot with a tattoo." The tattoo was of a Chinese symbol for the word mother. It was the same one Farver had on her foot. "It was shocking," Kava said. "It made me realize that Liz Golyer killed Carrie Farver, and she's taking photos of her body." At trial, Beadle painted Golyer as a diabolical and cruel woman who killed Farver and spent years violently harassing others. Golyer's defense attorney argued that all the evidence from the state was circumstantial, that at one point Golyer had been considered a victim in all of this and Farver's body hadn't been found. In 2017, Judge Timothy Burns found Golyer guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced her to life in prison. During his ruling, Burns said, "Carrie Farver did not voluntarily disappear and drop off of the face of the earth. Very sadly, she was murdered." In a statement to ABC News, the Omaha Police Department said the unusual nature of this case and the great lengths that Shannon Golyer went to hide this homicide undoubtedly perplexed everyone involved. The successful investigation between the Omaha Police Department and the County Sheriff's Office resulted in a successful prosecution of Shayna Golyer and brought to light an extreme level of deception that law enforcement rarely encounters. It continued, "Golyer remains at the Nebraska Correctional Center for Women. To this day, she maintains her innocence and claims Farver's real killer is still out there." Author Leslie Rule said she received letters from Golyer while she was behind bars, one of which said, "I will not stop fighting until I am set free and they find the right person." She obviously does not take responsibility for what happened, Rule said. "I want Liz to go away and never do this to anybody ever again," Krupa said. "Nancy and Carrie's son were foremost in my mind. They're unfortunately the ones that have to live with the repercussions." Krupa added that the investigators who solved the case, Dottie, Avis, Kava, they're all heroes. "Those guys, they mean the world to me, and I can't thank them enough. They're my boys," Nancy Rainey said. The three investigators established a scholarship fund in Farver's name at the local community college she had attended in hopes of associating something positive with her memory, Kava said. When asked how she wanted her daughter to be remembered, Rainey said, "As a fun-loving, talented, smart woman that she was." "Carrie was only 37 when she died," Rainey said. "If I could talk to Carrie right now, I would say, I love you. I'm so glad that you are in my life. You have a beautiful son who's got a wonderful life coming, and I miss you terribly."